The past 14 years, May has been researching and uncovering facts and evidence from between the lines of the news and placing them in a more thorough perspective of how conspiracy, political assassination, and abuses of power affect us all. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California. And now, May Brussel.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. It's Dialogue Conspiracy number 297. It's November 27th, 1977. I want to talk a little bit more this week on terrorism, not only in the Middle East, but how it affects us at home in the United States and the use of terrorism for control of our institutions here in the United States. Last week on Dialogue Conspiracy, I had Lydia Blades with me. She's a fine student of history, and we did an analysis that was mostly her interpretation, but it was interesting to me what was taking place with the meeting of Prime Minister Begin in Israel and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. The overt purpose, of course, of their meeting was allegedly to ask Israel to pull back their occupation of the Egyptian territory, the Sinai Desert, and to reconcile and recognize the Palestinians. That was the overt purpose of the meeting. Of course, if you followed the news after listening to Dialogue Conspiracy last week and read some of the articles coming out, you wonder why there's so much concern in the Arab world if this really was the purpose of the meeting, as stated. I doubt if it was because of the pressure of the CIA and Iran in the Middle East. There were follow-ups in the news after our program on Dialogue Conspiracy. There was a wire service, AP wire service, the next day from Beirut, Lebanon, that stated that Anwar Sadat is now the declared enemy of the leftist Arab world. They said this defection from the Arab banks is treason. Dr. George Habash, head of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, vowed to sabotage Sadat's agreements, which is interesting because Habash has been linked to the CIA, and I'll go further into that, and I've mentioned his name before. And it seems that Anwar Sadat can be set up possibly for assassination teams or to trigger off a war in the Middle East similar to World War I when Archduke Franz Ferdinand was shot. It seems that he's being set up, and they are making overt threats to kill Anwar Sadat at this time. Moscow had a news service, a wire story, calling Anwar Sadat's trip an unforgivable sin before history. These were 44 Egyptian students in Moscow. Another article said that Syria has started to form a new hardline front. Then I read the Libyan strongman, Mr. Gaddafi, flew to Damascus and pledged unlimited support for Syria financially and otherwise because of the meeting of Anwar Sadat and Mr. Begin. So that goes along the lines that we were talking about last Sunday night, because why would Syria be threatened if the Israelis were going to pull back from Sinai and recognize the PLO? Why would there be immediate need for support for Syria? The Washington Post had an article in quotes, "The visit of Sadat to Israel brought back the atmosphere reminiscent of bitter feuds that split Syria and Egypt during the Lebanese Civil War." The Washington Post also said that the Syrian newspapers were ordered not to print any pictures with Sadat and Mr. Begin. And Sadat, actually, when he went to Syria, brought his own food and his own cook for fear that if he went to Syria that he'd be poisoned, and he prepared his own food. He has been getting death threats. Anwar Sadat's answer to why he went to Israel directly without consulting any other of the Arab countries was that it was based upon his recent trip to Iran, which is a total CIA country, and to Romania and Saudi Arabia. The Washington Post had another article that the Arab hardliners are now likely to harbor suspicions that the U.S.-Saudi Arabian plot is with Israel at the expense of Syria and at the expense of the Palestinian organizations. And Jimmy Carter is claiming credit for the Sadat policy. So Anwar Sadat seems to be a tool of the American government and the CIA. And after going to Iran and getting instructions, he made the decision, evidently, that he would take this policy, whatever it is they're going to do in the Middle East. He's taking orders, and the various countries around him are very angry. And if you continue reading what's coming out of Lebanon and Syria and Iraq, you'll get a picture that substantiates a lot of the things that we were saying last week. There's a cartoon in the New York Times, a critical view, it's called, of Anwar Sadat, and it's a poster on the streets of Lebanon, and it has Sadat wearing a Moshe Dayan eye patch and an Uncle Sam hat, and above it, in Arabic, they have the word shalom, which is a Hebrew word for peace. So he's decorated with the American hat and the Israeli eye patch, and is causing a lot of consternation to people over there about whatever the balance of power is. He's making deals, evidently, that are under the table that don't have the express purpose that he stated he went over for, because those purposes were really very simple, if that's what he went for, and hardly anybody could object to peace in the Middle East if that's what it was really about. But this aura of peace could be shattered just like the way that Southeast Asia broke apart, and the Middle East is a powder keg, a possibility of war and intrigue, and it will continue that way. On November the 6th, several weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, on Dialogue Conspiracy number 293, for those of you that collect the tapes and have them, I talked about the assassination of Martin Luther King and a witness to a conversation of that assassination, a gentleman by the name of Robert Byron Watson, who lives in Marietta, Georgia, who claims that he was at the Magellan Galleries that were a center, or are a center in Georgia, for gold and silver smuggling, and also for narcotics and heroin traffic that goes to pay some very conservative, righteous men in our Congress in a skimming money outfit, I guess, similar to the Korean CIA payment of congressmen. I got a letter from Robert Watson this week. He was moved from Tennessee from the prison cell to a solitary confinement in Oklahoma, and he asked me to mention on Dialogue Conspiracy and in letters to public officials this week that he is being literally threatened. His life is not safe, and they have him in solitary, but they have him in the most strict, archaic, miserable federal prison he was in on some heroin that was planted on him, and his time will be out. He'll be out on parole soon if he's lucky or stays alive, but they put him in a terrible prison with the most hardened criminals, and he's afraid for his life. So if any of you are interested, you could write to your congressman about Robert Byron Watson, or call me or write to me for more information. What I said on the program at that time was that he had mentioned a Dr. Anthony Malik, M-A-L-E-K, who was a double agent who worked in Chile for the CIA and was there when Salvador Allende was killed, who also worked with what are supposed to be the left groups, but which are the extreme right-wing groups funded by the CIA. And he listed the Black September, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Watson also mentioned Dr. Fred Habash, who worked with Mr. Malik of the CIA. Habash also was in Chile, director for the San Diego office for the Palestinian organizations. And Dr. Fred Habash is the brother of Dr. George Habash, whose name has been linked to that airplane that was hijacked, and with the subsequent death that followed, the Lufthansa airplane that was hijacked October the 13th, 1977. Dr. George Habash's name came in because the people that hijacked this Lufthansa airline were linked to his organizations. The Los Angeles Herald Examiner said that the message received here said that the dead hijackers belonged to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, headed by Dr. George Habash. This front group has had several spectacular hijackings in the late 60s and in the 70s. And here is the important point about what I call terrorism on the right and the consequences of terrorism on the right. The Beirut newspaper said that they never heard of the PFLP, that group that had the Lufthansa airplane. Here's a man that is funding a group of people, or allegedly funding them, and the plane goes down, and these three people were murdered and called terrorists. And yet there's every indication that the funding of these people that caused this consternation and all the publicity on terrorism and the consequences of it in the news media with the police force comes from riotous organizations. As I say, the Beirut sources said they have never heard of this group and their operations, but they believed it was headed by Mr. Haddad, the same Mr. Haddad who's mentioned in the Chile operations and working with the CIA, and with Mr. Habash, a former associate of Mr. Habash. Now, that Lufthansa airplane that was hijacked to Somali had three people that were killed. One woman hijacker survived, but the background on these people was interesting. The people that were representing this Popular Front for Liberation Palestine were a splinter group just like the SLA that was never heard of by the officials before. The captain of the airplane carried a Dutch passport, and there's been so much espionage coming out of from Prince Bernhard and the Trilateral Commission out of Holland. It's interesting that he had a Dutch passport. He went under the name of Johannes Gertus, that was his alias, trained in a London aviation school as an engineer. He was killed. Three others were killed who had Iranian passports. Now, we know that Richard Helms is now working for the Shah of Iran in the United States and was the ambassador to Iran when the Watergate story broke. He left quickly and went on to Iran because that's where the action and counterintelligence is going to be, and the expertise of our CIA, former CIA director, Richard Helms, is needed. Popular Front group broke off from any Palestinian group. As I say, it was a strange group, and the three people that were killed on the spot, one was the pilot, a London-trained engineer with a Dutch passport. There was a woman named Nadia, 21 years old, who studied economics, a student of economics, and Nabi, who also had an Iranian passport, was living in the Christian area of Lebanon and studied in Tripoli. They were not Palestinians. They had Dutch and Iranian passports, all of them. And three were dead. One was hospitalized. So there was no way to link them to Dr. George Habash or to Dr. Haddad and the various right-wing CIA-funded operations. By killing these hijackers, the links are cut off, even though they weren't known previously. Now, the importance of the Lufthansa going down at that time and causing this consternation of our news, we see the evening television, if you watch it, maybe you don't, the covers of Time and Newsweek, and the big story, again, is terrorism. The effect of terrorism affects our lives at home. The Lufthansa hijacking isn't just an isolated incident. The way it affects our lives is exemplified in a convention that was held in October, the same week that the Lufthansa was taken down and these people from Iran and Holland with their passports caused these problems with that airplane. That same week in San Juan, Puerto Rico, was a meeting of top officials, quote officials, but obviously from the CIA fronts, to meet in San Juan, Puerto Rico over a subject which is described in a large article in the Washington Post called Controlling Terrorists Poses a Dilemma for Democracy. Prominent government and industry consultants met in Puerto Rico, and their purpose was to how to handle their mutual frustrations about terrorism. And the conclusions they had at this convention were that the industrial democracies, such as the United States and West Germany, are now in conflict with the necessary measures to control terrorists. In other words, democracy can't survive if you give in to the terrorists, but democracy is too weak to handle the terrorists. Now, we know what Adolf Hitler did with terrorism, with the Reichstag fire, blaming the left, arresting the left, and taking them off. And out of the woodworks come people with the mentality of Adolf Hitler on the solution for terrorism. And the conclusion of their convention was, of course, that maybe we should give up our freedom and have more surveillance, more wiretapping, opening of mail. And this convention was timed the same week that this, as I say, this Lufthansa airplane was hijacked. One of the speakers at the convention was Aaron Katz, K-A-T-Z-H, who organized the conference. And he began by saying, the terrorist is the cutting knife against the throat of civilization, and began to attack the terrorist. And he said, the species cannot survive, the human species cannot survive if we have these terrorists. We have to handle them with measures that are very extreme. This was the suggestion about handling these terrorists. Now, the same time the conference was taking place and the Lufthansa went down, just 4 days before the start of the conference, the president of the San Juan, Puerto Rico chapter of the Federal Bar Association was assassinated. His name is Alan Randall, and he's an attorney, and he was murdered. And left on him at the time of his murder was a note by an unidentified group that was never heard before, just as the SLA was never heard of, or that Palestinian group were not heard of before. And the note mentioned the conference that was going to take place. Now, this kind of assassination before a meeting or an action is typical of CIA violence. At the time that Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were killed in Chicago, the Black Panthers, the police were told that these men had killed a police officer a short time before. So when they went in and machine gunned the beds with a vengeance, they were getting even for their brother who was shot. Just before the shootout in L.A., when the SWAT teams set fire to that home and the LAPD murdered the six people inside of the house, they were told that Donald DeFries had killed a cop just a short time before, and then it turned out to be untrue, and they went in with a vengeance. Well, when this committee met in San Juan, Puerto Rico, just 4 days before this Alan Randall was murdered, the attorney with a note identifying to some leftist group that doesn't exist, but which causes a counter-reaction at the meeting. And the panelists all agreed unanimously under tight security after the death of Alan Randall that to control terrorism, we need more infiltration, we need more surveillance of organizations, that the FBI and CIA have been abandoned because we said they were intruding into our privacy, and that we're literally cutting them off, and we shouldn't be afraid of the FBI or the CIA or our First Amendment or our civil rights because, as they said at the meeting, look at the terrorists. Now, the well-known Stefan Pisani from Stanford Research Institute gave a speech. He's from the think tank that has the bulwark of czarists and pro-Nazis, well-known students of terrorism, but victims of communists taking over their country and their extreme right wing, and they will do anything to get back this territory or avenge the takeover of their home grounds, particularly in Tsarist Russia. Mr. Pisani from Stanford said at the conference, and this is a quote, "With limitations upon us and with a lack of legal rules and legal procedures or training, our law enforcement is in no position to suppress terrorists at the moment. You have a political problem on your hands." And he says it is politics, because certain political parties could be soft on communism, and that would prevent the use of tools to bring terrorism under control. What we have to have, said Mr. Pisani from Hoover Institute of War and Peace, was more electronic surveillance, more mail openings, more telephone surveillance. We need new and more restrictive systems of passport surveillance. Then Patrika Atau, president of Research West, which I'm sure is a CIA front in California. It's called Research West, California-based company that advises business and concerned persons about kidnappings and sabotage, gave a speech. This party said, "We have a mania with privacy that has become a fraud on the American public." This is like 1984, and all of this comes because of these big kidnappings of planes that are financed by the CIA in the first place, and then the counter-reaction comes in at the time of their convention with the death of a lawyer and the Lufthansa kidnapped, and we get the pilot and the three people, the terrorists there, with their passports from Holland and Iran. And yet, Patrika Howe says, A-T-T-H-O-W-E, "We have a mania with privacy that is a fraud. What the government is saying, what the United States government is saying, we will keep you safe from the FBI and leave you open to attack from the weathermen." Now, I really seriously doubt that we would be attacked by these terrorists in the United States if we got rid of the FBI and the CIA. But Atau went on to say, he said, "I hold here two urban guerrilla manuals that were published in California with details on how to make explosives and napalm." And he holds them for the convention and begins to tell you about them. And then he goes into the SLA, of course, and the danger of these people from the radical groups being terrorists on our street, which just wasn't true and could be proved to be a CIA operation, the SLA. But he then brings in Patricia Sultan and goes in to the SLA members. Johann Alexander, the director for Institute of Studies of International Terrorism from New York State, spoke. And I don't know what nationality is or what he cares about the American Constitution. But what he said, according to the Washington Post, is the First Amendment comes in for a beating at this meeting, that the terrorists are free to manipulate the media, but the democratic people, the so-called Democratic people, are being taken by media promotion of these terrorists, which again isn't true. The media cooperates with the CIA. And he blamed the media, the press, as leading and contributing to terrorism. The 10 leading contributors to terrorism, the press is one of them. He doesn't go into the actual causes of poverty or why people would become radicalized. But yet the terrorists that brought this meeting on are not actually terrorists, and they were killed on the spot, and their links were to fascist regimes and CIA money. They had a discussion about who is a terrorist without clearly defining it. But the consensus of the meeting was, we have to strengthen, again, our surveillance. We need more surveillance. Now, Mr. Posoni from Stanford University gave an analysis of terrorists, and he says they're more likely people who suffer from basic perversions, and he gives examples of the Meinhof gang without proving really who funded them, because all of them are dead and died in the jail. And again, Patrice Salznick from the SLA. Mr. Posoni said the key to terrorism is women who lead terrorist groups. They're usually bisexual females. This is, again, a CIA profile hitting the women as being the violent ones. And he goes into sadomasochism is a crucial point among the terrorists. It's interesting that the CIA comes out with these profiles, psychological profiles on terrorism, and yet none of these terrorists live to go to trial or tell the truth, and the source of their funds is never provided, and yet the beat goes on, and these conventions give you an analysis of a terrorist profile, a terrorist background, and yet there's no proof that it's not funded by the CIA, and there's more proof that it is funded by the CIA with its links to the high-up military and the Pentagon. The professor from Stanford University talked about suicidal tendencies in terrorists. This is brought out because they're just killed on the spot. These people aren't suicidal. Donald DeFries wasn't suicidal, and neither was Nancy Ling Perry or Angela Atwood. The autopsy report showed that in the case of the SLA, they were shot at close range. And in fact, there was a report that Donald Gray, the nephew of Patrick Gray of the FBI, shot them in the back of the house so that they couldn't escape. Remember when the SWAT teams killed the SLA in Los Angeles, they said that these people were very suicidal and wanted to die, and yet the bodies of the several females were just about outside the house. They came out from the back door and were shot down, and Donald DeFries was shot in the head, and Nancy Ling Perry in the spine in the back, and Angela Atwood between her eyes. I believe that was the way it was with those two. They were shot at close range. They weren't suicidal. They didn't shoot themselves at all. But the terrorists can be programmed to do this violence as an excuse to justify the illegal activities that the FBI and CIA were into at the time of Watergate. See, Watergate broke the story of domestic counterintelligence and the use of the CIA infiltrating, opening our mail, listening to our telephones, the National Security Agency, even the telegrams, a total invasion of privacy going into the opponent's offices in election year, following the candidates, bugging them, discrediting them. And the next episode after the 1972 elections was going to be terrorism in America. I wrote about that in my article, The SLA is the CIA. And if any of you don't have that article, you can write to me. If you send a dollar, I still have some of those. And I think if you read that article now, you would see what I meant when I wrote that in 1974. This is 3 years later. And I had one of the motives of causing this kind of domestic violence and kidnapping and fear was the excuse for the federal government to come in and the FBI and CIA and do that kind of wiretapping and opening of mail and taking over our private lives like 1984. If we get enough outside domestic terrorism, kidnapping of people and airplanes hijacked, and all of the alleged hijackers are murdered, and yet they have these mysterious passports and links to the CIA, what we get at home is the counter-reaction, the conventions, the experts that come out of the woodwork and analyze violence for us. And yet, all the evidence of these experts in the news media that I take, if I put together all the various newspapers, is evidence that it is coming from the intelligence community, just identical to the way that Hitler brought terror and blamed it on the left so that he could take total control of the government. I wanted to mention one other subject today for 2 minutes before our time is up. On the committee in Washington, to keep you up with that, the House Select Committee on Assassinations has been working along. They have a report coming out soon. Mark Lane was one of the original founders of this committee. I had no credence in it. I didn't trust Senator Schweiker. I didn't trust Congressman Gonzalez. I didn't like the people back there who were handling it, and didn't have much confidence in them. I did talk to Robert Blakey, their head counsel. I don't trust him at all. He's from the Justice Department, and he's working with the Justice and the CIA. I think he's a miserable cover-up artist. Mark Lane has now divulged to Ted Gandolfo in New York City that he has no confidence in the committee at all. He thinks that they'll throw a lot of things under the rug. He mentioned that they want to hide the John Kennedy assassination, and they're emphasizing the Martin Luther King. They're both important, but the committee is throwing a lot of material away or not using it. Mark Lane went to see James Earl Ray and recorded hours of conversation with him and asked Ted Gandolfo to put this on the air and on tapes, and I will be playing some of it for you soon. He wants it disseminated around the world because he doesn't trust the committee. Originally, the men that worked with the committee swore of secrecy of what they were doing, but it seems that Mark Lane now wants the material out. And I wish that Congress would call off their investigation. I think something will come of it, but not the whole truth. And I know that the witnesses that I've mentioned on this program that were important to me, such as Gary Powers and George DeMornchild and William Sullivan, have all been murdered. Before they were brought to appear before the committee, they were murdered. It almost seems that if I give a profile or rundown on the next important witness, they'll be murdered. So let's say that I think Marina Oswald is probably the most important witness now, and Robert Mayhew. If I were heading the committee back there, I would call Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Robert Mayhew and Marina Oswald. And I will be sending information back them again on these people. And let's see what their longevity is. These are the next most important links, being as Gary Powers and William Sullivan and George DeMornchild are dead. There are still some witnesses around that could tell the whole story, but it's very intimidating and frightening to see these witnesses murdered just before they testify or right after they testify. And it's harder to put the pieces together, of course, when they're dead. So I do keep up with what the committee's doing back there. And as I say, Harold Weisberg is very despondent about the committee. He's written books on the assassination, the series on Whitewash, four of them, and one on Frame Up, Martin Luther King's assassination. He has nothing to do with the committee. Penn Jones has written four books, Forgive My Grief, and he doesn't work with the committee in Washington. We think they're all pretty bad cover-up artists, and it's pitiful the way they're going about their work. Well, that's it for tonight. This is Dialogue Conspiracy. I'll see you next week. This is Mae Brussel on KLRB, and we'll see you next Sunday night. Until then, take care and have a good rest of the holidays, and we'll be back next Sunday.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy with Mae Brussel.
A few minutes on this tape were conversations I had with Terry Moore and Glenn Brewer about Howard Hughes. I had a few minutes because there was a commercial on KLRB, and this part of my cassette was still on the tape, and I thought you'd enjoy sharing it with me. It's Terry Moore, the actress who was married to Howard Hughes for 8 years, with Glenn Brewer, who was Hughes' aide, and they are conversing about, they're reminiscing about Howard Hughes and their experiences with him. You hear on this tape are Glenn Brewer and Terry Moore, the actress, talking about Howard Hughes, about the reason that Hughes was going to move to Nevada and the control he could have over the two senators in Nevada.
He was going to move the aircraft there.
Yeah.
He wanted to buy an airfield to have
he
the big
place
there.
He said we were going to control the state, you know, own two senators.
Well, he did control the state.
Yeah, but this is before he even moved there. He told me what we were going to do.
Right. he could do things there that he couldn't possibly do in California.
I don't
he
see
loved
how.
Going, he loved excitement. He liked going out every night. He liked going to shows every night.
Yeah.
He wasn't a stay-at-home. No. You know, Bob Slater said, now, what did you do? Did you sit around? I mean, did he wear a robe around the place? Did you sit home nights watching television? Well, he evidently watched television late. We never watched television. I mean, when he was finished with his work, we went out to dinner. We went out. I mean, if we didn't make love, the only time we stayed home was to make love, you know. But then we would go out and go to every night with Vegas. We'd go out to a different show. I mean, we'd take $20. When that was gone, remember, he'd get it. That was, that. Then you quit gambling. We were only allowed to lose $20 between us, the two of us. But he wanted to be out every night. Right. Or go down to Goldwyn. We'd run motion pictures with
he
Carl.
He wasn't cheap on money. He just knew that it wasn't wise. He
Carrie
knew
that.
He knew that. He had a mathematical mind. And he knew that it was better for the house. It was just stupidity.
Oh,
whenever
absolutely.
He gave me money to get...